Welcome to the Story Powers Podcast, the show about the power of stories, the people who tell them, and why you should be doing it too. I'm your host, keynote speaker and storytelling coach, Francisco Mafus. My guest today is Perry Hedrick. Perry is the founder of Crackle PR, a public relations agency that works with good companies only. With over 20 years of experience in the PR industry, Perry is a PR and communications generalist who understands what makes your story crackle and has worked with companies like Bing, Google, Oracle, Yelp, Logitech, and many more. Now, all of that sounds really impressive, sure, but here's what really does it for me. Perry is the LinkedIn king of emoji storytelling. He used to be a Superman underwear child model, and he believes what he preaches so much that his LinkedIn profile features two viral posts which are exactly the same post. It's just a shame he has a policy of not dealing with assholes, so this podcast might be a very short one indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, Perry Hedrick. Perry, welcome to the show.
What a pleasure, and what a talk up. My goodness, how am I gonna succeed with that? Okay.
Tell me, is the LinkedIn thing, because I was very surprised. Like, did you realize it is the same post? Because you have two like super viral posts in there, and it's the same post.
Yeah, well, that's not a coincidence, and it's not an accident. So one of the things that I always say about your best content is it's a little bit like your best outfit. You wouldn't wear it only once and then throw it away. You want to wear it multiple times, probably to different locations, because, you know, it's a lot of money and took a lot of effort. So that one post in particular, I love, because it's such a contrarian sort of slap in the face to people who don't understand what communications is and the many things that PR and comms professionals do. So it's a litany. It's a battery of all the things that we actually do. And so I'll post that maybe once every 3 months, just as a reminder, like, hey, folks, if you think it's just us picking up the phone and calling our buddies at the Wall Street Journal, take a look at this list of things we actually do. And it resonates with all the people that follow me on LinkedIn. They're like, yes, somebody is finally listing it all out, all of the things that we really do. So yes, you'll see it again. You've seen it before. You'll see it again.
I was actually surprised that marketing should report to PR wasn't on that list, because I'd imagine that one, maybe that one went viral, but there's too much trash talking in the comments for you to want it in there. But yeah, I was expecting I would see that one there.
That one was super contentious, and understandably so, because of the current framework where PR reports into marketing. But I still think that there ought to be some parity between marketing and comms. And possibly those two groups are on level footing and they report up to brand, perhaps. But my thinking is evolving on that, and I don't know, but I will tell you that post got the most vitriol for marketers than you can possibly imagine. I had so many DMs from people being like, are you crazy? You have it all wrong. And then millions of DMs from PR people saying, yes, somebody finally said it. So anytime you can create that natural tension in a post, it's usually good. But I'm not going back to the well with that one, because people will remember that one for sure.
Yeah, I want to talk a lot about the PR stuff. But one thing that I was very interested in find out when I was doing some research for this episode was your background in journalism. So I understand that you were a journalist until around the time where one of your stories got the beautiful headline of "Toxic Boy's Illness Still a Mystery," right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I was a straight news reporter working for mid-sized daily newspapers. And the story behind that headline was there was a child in the town that, or the city that I was working in, who had come down with a very serious rash. And it was believed to be because there were companies dumping chemicals into his backyard. And so over a period of time, I earned the trust of the mother and the family to gain access to them to interview them about what had happened. And the newspaper had asked if we could take photographs of the boy, just like of the rash. And they were like, no, no, no. But I brought a camera anyway, just in case I could earn their trust. And over the course of the interview, I did. I earned the trust. And the mother said, I suppose it's okay as long as you treat this with dignity and, you know, all that. So I was excited that I had the scoop. It was going to be the lead story on the next day's top of the fold newspaper. And I had the artwork to show the rash that the whole town was worried about, like, this stuff is going to, you know, encroach into our neighborhoods. So I wrote the story. It was a straight piece, had the photograph, went home. this is a Friday night. And then on Sunday morning, I went downstairs to grab the newspaper, and splashed across the page was that the torso of the boy. But the headline that you just said was "Toxic Boy's Illness Still a Mystery," in quotation marks, as if somebody had called him Toxic Boy. No one did. No one ever had. So the fact that they wrote that headline that way was just a really sensationalistic take on that story. And it absolutely infuriated me, because the mother had pleaded with me to treat the story with dignity and care, and I assured her I would. And then an overzealous headline writer, to try to sell more newspapers, took it too far. And that was kind of the beginning of the end for me in journalism, because that was not the first time that it happened. And I just felt increasingly that the sensationalistic piece of journalism was overriding what my idea was, which was altruistic, you know, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Like, all of the proper tenets of journalism was kind of going away. So I thought, how to parlay my skills into a way where I can still use my writing, but have a different career. And here I am in PR.
Were you able to reach out to that family after the headline came out?
Not only did I reach out, I went to the front door of the family's home and knocked on the door probably three different times trying to gain access, and they didn't let me in. In fact, one time I saw them close the curtains. Mm-hmm. And so that was really painful for me. It was a really rude awakening for me, because I was just trying to do good, and it really blew up in my face.
Yeah, I can imagine why they wouldn't want to talk to you, but I also can see your side of it. So before it sort of went sour to you, I believe I've heard you mention that you actually, like, you had been doing it for a while. We found out you're good at it. I think you actually had won some awards for whatever journalism you were doing. So one of the things that we'll come back to is this idea of what a story is in different contexts. So when you were doing journalism, what was your understanding of what a story was? Like, how did you look at, okay, I have to write this story. Did you just do it instinctively? Was there any sort of framework that you had that you got used to, or that you were taught that you felt made for a good story?
Yeah, I think it was more instinctive than anything. I did end up going to Boston University, and I studied journalism and all of that. But for me, writing has always been something that, I don't want to say comes naturally, but it is more of a feeling than anything. So when I take the body of the story that I'm working on, there's a bunch of different pieces, and I try to work in my head, what is the thing that will grab the reader by the throat, like, out of the gate? What is the thing I can open with that will immediately have people's ears perk up and think, oh, I need to read the rest of that? And so for me, it was always the opening graph that mattered most. I didn't have a framework in place with all the, you know, pieces in a row. I didn't follow necessarily inverted pyramid and all the traditional sort of teachings. For me, it was, I couldn't write the story until I had that opening line. And once I had that, then everything just, it was like a release. Everything just flows from there. And I think subconsciously, I've always known that the least important things can kind of be at the end. But I've kind of flipped that model. I always try to finish really strong and begin really strong. And in the middle is where the editor is going to cut out pieces, because I want to leave you with a powerful statement at the end. So I kind of reject the traditional model where you have the, you know, it gets increasingly less important and they can just cut off the bottom. I like to have a strong finish at the end as well.
And did you find that whatever came instinctively to you, were editors okay with that? Did you find that your pieces were usually, okay, well, this is good writing, I'll cut this here and there? Or did you get a lot of pushback for whatever your natural style was?
So this is going to sound a little bit like bragging, and I don't intend it to sound this way. But when I was in college, I started working at a mid-sized daily newspaper. And within, you know, a couple of weeks, I was the general assignment reporter, tasked with covering the top stories of the day. And I think the reason why was because I had more of an emotional beginning to my stories. Story is the operative word, right? So a lot of reporting sometimes is just a compilation of facts. But for me, it was always about trying to draw people in by coming up with the powerful opening line. And so I think I've always just naturally been able to write with the emotional triggers required of keeping readership hooked. And because of that, I really quickly earned a reputation at the newspaper and every place I've been since for being somebody who can be compelling out of the gate. And that same thing applies, by the way, to LinkedIn. I'm not sure if we're going to talk about that, but LinkedIn is the same thing where, you know, I've had a lot of success on that platform primarily because of what I just said, which is if you can get them with the opening line, they tend to stick with you. And so for whatever reason, that has always just come naturally for me. But I will say I'm colorblind, and a lot of my stories that I used to write would have really sort of evocative descriptions of colors and, you know, the what the perpetrator was wearing and all of that, because observationally I felt deficient in that regard. So I would always ask so many questions around what the colors of things were. And I would weave that into my story in a way that was probably overcompensating. But because I did, it was a little more vivid than the traditional writing, I think. So, you know, I think I took a deficiency and turned it into an asset.
That's really interesting, because I wouldn't, it's not something that outside of a sort of a journalistic story, I would necessarily think, you know, what the colors of people's clothing is the type of detail that to my storytelling taste, a lot of people love doing, but it's one of the least important things you can ever tell us about a character, unless it's the one thing you want us to remember that character for. But you know, it's one of the things I sort of rail against when I'm talking to people about storytelling, which is there's a certain amount of description that works in literature, might work in journalism, but doesn't tend to work at all in oral storytelling, which is my drug of choice. And because just nobody talks that way, right? You don't say, you know, so I'm walking down the street and this guy wearing this green shirt and blue trousers, I mean, green shirt and blue trousers, maybe because it's so out of the ordinary, but you wouldn't describe, you know, blue jeans, right? So like, who cares if he's wearing jeans or not? Like, what's the guy doing? Who's the guy, right?
Well, think about the context. Think about the context that I'm talking about, though. So as a reporter, I was covering motorcycle accidents, homicides, and all of that. And so when, as an example, you're at the scene of a homicide and the mother of the victim sitting on a curb in a crisp blue shirt spattered with blood, that tends to have some imagery that you can relate to and actually see that mother feel what she's feeling. She was probably having a good day with her clean clothes, and now she has the blood of her dead son on her shirt. You know, those kind of things, I think, work. I want to be really clear. I'm not gratuitous with the colors and all of that descriptors, unless I think they add something to the story. And it's kind of like goes back to the whole Chekhov's gun thing, right? Like, you don't want to put a gun on the mantle that you don't intend to discharge. I won't lead the readers astray. I will only add the color and those little seemingly unimportant details if they actually bring to life what they're presently looking at.
We will get around maybe very, very briefly to LinkedIn, but when it comes to opening lines, and again, maybe the approach you have is the same now that it used to be, but did you have anything you're particularly looking for? As in, okay, well, I want an opening line and these are my, you know, I have 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 go-tos and this is the type of thing I'm looking for, or you were looking at the story and then you thought, oh, this detail would work really well up there.
So if you're asking specifically about LinkedIn, for me, it's always be a contrarian. So, you know, the world of PR professionals, everyone's afraid to say something controversial because they'll lose a client. I own my business, and so I am not afraid. If I lose a client because of something I say, they're not the right client for me. So what I have tried to do, my whole persona on that platform and my whole writing style generally is to be a truth teller. And so my opening lines on LinkedIn, my opening lines in bylined articles, contributed pieces, whatever it tends to be, is a provocative sort of contrarian look at what people think is obvious, and then delve more deeply into why what they've always thought is true is not. So as an example, in public relations, everybody always thinks it's the relationships you have with reporters that matters. They think they're paying me $15,000 a month because I know the editors at the New York Times. Well, that may be true. I may know the editors at the New York Times, but that's where the relationship ends. It might have them pick up the phone. It might have them read my email. But if the story sucks, they're not going to write about it. So that is a huge myth that I would say 80% of business leaders think they're paying PR people for the relationship they have, as if we're sort of like in this secretive underworld, you know, where we can call in a favor to the mafia and like get a story written. And that's an exact opposite. And also exactly the kind of thing that I like to illustrate is that what everybody thinks is wrong.
And did you find that, I mean, being a contrarian was probably not the approach you were using when you were doing journalistic stories. Was there anything that you tended to gravitate towards when you were writing those?
When I was writing journalistic stories, probably the biggest source fodder for my pieces was silence. And by that, I mean, let's say I'm talking to a politician about something particularly terrible in the town. You ask a question, they give an answer, and then rather than follow up quickly with another question, you just pause. And what tends to happen is people who are being interviewed can't stand the silence, and they fill the silence with more talking. They can't bear to have that silence. So they'll start blathering on and just saying more and more and more and more. And that's where the real gold was found in storytelling, particularly with politicians who, again, just cannot bear the silence. So they will keep talking and ultimately divulge things they weren't intending to divulge and give you the bits and pieces that they never should have given if they've had media training. And that's where the gold lies.
So what you're suggesting is I should really just shut up and see what comes out after you felt uncomfortable enough looking into my eyes.
You should try it. You will be surprised. Don't try it with me because I know the trick, but you will get the most interesting things if you just stare and let them continue to talk. It is crazy. It's the human condition. You have to fill the vacuum.
I remember when I got into financial services a lifetime ago. And I had this manager who was really into teaching people conversational skills. He didn't believe this idea that, like, if you cannot build rapport with clients, like, you can't be taught. He said, no, 100% you can be taught. There is technique for that. And one exercise we did on a regular basis was we would all get into a circle, and then you would start a conversation with one of us pretending to be a client. And then the next person had to keep the conversation going with a natural sounding question. And, you know, if I said, oh, I love living in Barcelona, and the next question has to be something like, why? Or where were you before? What is your favorite thing? Or whatever. And this boss that taught me this, Mike, he said that the best question you can ever ask, not really a question, was go on. Or he would just do it with his hand. He'd just, I'm listening. And his people would just keep giving you stuff. And like, if you run now, just go on. Like, you're not done with that. Keep talking. And we did genuinely get some really good tidbits that way. Now, I've seen you talk about this all the time. This is in sort of a way your shtick on LinkedIn, how people misunderstand PR, which is kind of paradoxical, isn't it? I mean, doesn't PR need better PR? Because I went to a communication university. I did advertising for a very little time in Brazil before I quit and did something else. And I remember the common joke is we didn't really know what the PR people were doing. Like it was split into advertising, journalism, and PR. And there was all this sort of stereotype of press releases and annoying reporters for stories. Why is it that it's so difficult to understand, or what is this impression that it's so difficult to understand what PR professionals are doing?
I think part of it is a self-inflicted wound on the part of the PR industry. And I say that because the example I gave to you earlier about people believing that we have these like incredible relationships that we can just call favors in, that is not true. But because the PR industry knows that that's what the executives want to hear, they pretend that their relationships are the strongest and best in the industry. So they reinforce the misconception because they want the revenue. And that is just a fact. So there are agencies that know better. Everybody that is in PR and has been in PR as long as I know, knows that the relationships will get you only so far. They'll get you to the gate, but you're not going to get a story. But everybody in the industry, I would say the vast majority of people pretend that those relationships are the reason why they should be hired when they're getting interviewed, while they're getting vetted. So it's self-inflicted. And they just know the game. They know that if they tell the prospect what they want to hear, then they'll win. So it's a vicious cycle. And I'm actively out there selling against that idea. I want everybody to finally just admit, like, that is bullshit. Like, that is not what we do. That is not why you're paying us. What we actually do are these 45 other awesomely important things that help build a halo effect on your brand. We're not one trick ponies where we just call an editor and get a story written. So I don't know. For me, you'll find that I rail against the traditional viewpoint of PR because I feel like we get short shrift. I feel like we're not at the big boys table. I feel like we're not in the boardroom. And it's in part because we do ourselves that disservice of packaging up we do as only one thing that the people want to hear. Whereas to your point earlier in this program, where you talked about my two viral posts, the reason why they're viral is because somebody's finally listing out all of the things we actually do. And it's an incredible amount of things. And PR people are wickedly talented and very diverse and are super analytical and really, really cool under fire. But instead, the industry sells itself on the idea that we'll get your CEO on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Full stop.
Yeah, I've seen you talk about many times about how there's no amount of relationships that are going to get you airtime if the story is not good. So for the purposes of the work you do, what do you think of as the story? And I think this is might be more than one thing, I would expect.
It is more than one thing. But for me, it all begins and ends with strategic narrative. And when I say strategic narrative, what do I mean? Well, in the case of the clients that I work with, primarily technology companies, B2B tech, what that really means is creating almost a movement around the new way they are doing whatever thing it is, right? So the idea is you're creating an existential battle between the new way you represent and the old way everybody else is doing it. And if you can distill that difference in a meaningful way, it's a message that internally your people will rally behind and run toward, and external audiences will want to run toward it too. Because it's not a transaction at that point where they're swiping a credit card, but rather they feel like they're joining a movement, the new way of doing things. And if you're, and everybody else can do it the old way, and they're suckers because they don't understand how much better this is. So that's strategic narrative. And once you can kind of get that high level, okay, boom, this is the differentiator. This is why we're bigger and better. Then you can reverse engineer a PR program around that to make sure that you're mapping everything you do and say to this one goal, which is that big, beautiful message you've created, that strategic narrative piece. So that's the most important thing for me from a storytelling standpoint. And then everything else is just components of it. You know, there's a bunch of tactics that support it, like press releases and, you know, bylined articles and case studies and podcasts, for example, and, you know, all of that.
And do you ever tend to think of the story in a much more atomized way? So, you know, this is the strategic narrative. I would normally think of that as the narrative. I think a lot of people, there's a lot of confusion about what people call these things. But do you ever think of the story as in a story? As in, there is this one thing we want to tell you about. There's this one thing that happened to the company or to the founder or to whoever. And you're reaching out to get that to a reporter or to whoever, to trying to get the story out there. And it's one story. Or it's always just part of the strategic narrative.
So I wrote a piece yesterday, I think, that kind of hits on this, which is, or maybe it was today even, where when I'm being vetted by like a CEO or a CMO, we'll ask all of the questions about what they're trying to accomplish, their goals, their audience, like all of that. And then toward the end, I'll typically ask, you know, I'll put them on the spot and say, okay, so we've heard a lot of things, but if you could write one headline about your company right now, it doesn't have to be wordsmith, doesn't have to be perfect. But what's the headline? Like, what is the thing that you, the one thing you would love to see as a headline? And that's a really revealing moment because sometimes they know exactly what it is and they are quick with that answer, which means they've done the work. They know their story. And then if they hire us, we just need to execute because they've already got that thing locked in and buckled down. But very often what we hear is some kind of, that's a good question, or that's difficult to answer because, and they themselves don't know what that story is. They're not sure because there's a lot of pieces. Some of it is changing. Maybe there's acquisitions. There's a lot of things moving. And they are kind of rudderless when it comes to that storytelling piece. They don't quite know themselves. And that's when there's a hell of a lot more work involved. So to answer your question, ideally, the messaging piece is figured out very early on. And by messaging, I mean story. Like, this is the story. Let's go tell this story in myriad ways across verticals, across all these platforms and channels, social included. But very often it's a matter of putting in the hard work up front with the C-suite to figure out what is that one shiny thing we want the world to know. And then how do we atomize it, to your point, across the various channels and verticals and audiences where we're speaking and tailoring it to them. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I think the question, and this is something I come across a lot when I'm talking to people who are running their own company. And to be fair, even I'm talking to people who are sort of solopreneurs, is you can get very good at telling stories, a news story as a type of communication, and that has its power. But if there is no overarching narrative behind that, then you're not necessarily building on anything. Whereas if very clearly you have a story and every single piece, post, or you know, whatever, a YouTube video or whatever you're using adds to that story, then you're starting to get yourself a brand or to stand out from everyone else in a particular way. If you only have the atomized version, you know, the one post that is told through a story and that goes really well, that's great, but it doesn't necessarily, it's never going to build to the type of movement you were talking about.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. It's the aggregate of all the things that we just talked about that builds that halo effect over your brand. The aggregate. So there's a lot of pieces when it comes to public relations to that. So to your point, you have to be telling that story to everyone and in the ways that they digest it to make it make sense and map to the bigger goal. And I think that's really, really important. But there's also got to be consistency from the way it's communicated internally across the C-suite, right? So like most of the companies we work with, they have like 5 to 7 different spokespeople. And it's critically important that each of these spokespeople, they're all singing from the same hymn book. They all know the story. They have it locked in cold. So you can have an interviewer interview all 5 of them and they're saying basically the same thing, hitting on the key messages, talking about the brand promise, you know, the same way. But so many organizations have fractured communications internally about what they are and who they've done it with. And a large part because of things like turnover, where there's a new CMO or they acquired a new company and now they talk about it in a different way. And so sometimes the biggest organizations are the worst at it because they have so many moving parts and they have, you know, 50 different people saying 50 different shades of the wrong story. And that's when it gets really, really challenging.
Yeah. What I wonder is, because I know nothing about PR, nothing at all. So when I read that viral post of yours, I started reading it and I'm like, but hold on, you said we are not about press releases. I thought that was one of the main things. And it took me a while to realize what you're doing. It's like, I feel a twist coming. So when I, like, if someone brought me in, and they won't, but if someone brought me in to try and do anything with storytelling with a company in the type of media that PR does, one thing I would do, and I don't know if this is at all a practice that PR professionals do, but one thing I would do is I would interview everyone that matters in the universe of the company and try to find as many stories that actually back up the thing that we're trying to be known for or the thing we're trying to represent or whatever we want our brand to be. And then I would try and find ways to have those small individual stories spread or, you know, be used as content or whatever. Now, is this a normal PR practice? Does this not work for some reason?
I would say it's not normal. I would say we do it and probably some of the more sophisticated firms do it. I write posts about this all the time that the PR agency should be interviewing the sales team in particular, the marketers for sure, and the C-suite, because those are the three buckets that have the most sort of breadth at a company. But if you're not interviewing the salespeople, for example, you have no idea what they're encountering out in the wild and like what the competitive landscape is looking like and all of that. So it's really, really important to have all those voices. And to your point, you can actually mine for really interesting stories from folks that aren't typically talked to a lot and surprise you with what they know and what they see out there. It reminds me a little bit of like there was a bunch of commercials a few years ago for IBM. IBM is this big, huge company. Everybody knows IBM. But they look at it as this sort of stodgy machine and not as a bunch of actual people doing actual work. And so IBM intelligently, I think, came out with a bunch of ads that were showing people out in the field or doing what they were doing every day. So I'm an IBMer. And they would show all these slices of life of people actually doing the work and doing the job. And it humanized the brand in a way that was never possible without that. And so I think, for us, what we're always trying to do is find human examples within companies, whether it's sales, whether it's marketing, whether it's the C-suite, whether it's ideally customers, to tell the story for the brand. Like for me, in 2024, the biggest asset you can have isn't the CEO. It isn't the sales guy. It isn't the CMO, any of those. It's the customers actually using your products or services and them explaining how it benefited them, their lives, their sanity. Like, the customer is king right now. So if I could give one single bit of advice to anybody looking to tell PR, it would be forget your CEO, forget all of the "we're going to change the world" rhetoric of the past that sold really well in the year 2000. And instead, it's the customer saying, "I cannot live without this product, the service, this company. It fundamentally changed my life." So that's the future of storytelling, is forget the company. It's all about the customer.
How does that interact with something else I've heard you talk about before, where you, something like along the lines of the CEO should be the lead storyteller of a company?
Yeah, that's perfect. And I believe that is true. And by lead storyteller, I mean, it shouldn't be the CMO that's out there doing these interviews, trying to explain the company's movement and growth and all of that. The CEO needs to be invested in it, because if the CEO is invested in PR, that goes from the top down all the way through the company. But typically what happens is the CEO is removed and doesn't really know what's happening over there in PR. And when you have that disconnect, it's really hard to have one cohesive, consistent message that we talked about across the company and across everybody in it. So they always say the fish rots from the head down. In this case, the PR program rots when the CEO isn't actively involved. So this does not mean that when I say storytelling, that the CEO is talking about how wonderful he or she is and how wonderful the company is. In fact, it's really a great entree to talk about how customers like, you know, X United and these guys are benefiting from the following efficiencies that we're building out. In fact, Joe at this company was able to do blah, blah, blah. It's using the customers to be able to illustrate the point. So if my only point there is that when you have a company, when you have a brand, the CEO ideally is the lead storyteller, like Mark Benioff at Salesforce.com. So he is just the master at it. He is always available to talk to the press. Everybody knows who he is. And they look and say, well, if he can do it, then we better get on the same page, because look at him out there, like, selling his ass off in these stories right now. So for me, I will die on the hill that ideally the CEO is the one who is the lead storyteller, and everybody else takes their marching orders from him or her.
Yeah, I was thinking of LinkedIn now, and something that it's advice that goes round, and then some people rail against it, but stuff like, you know, people being authentic and things of that nature. And I'm thinking, how many CEOs, and again, this will depend on the size of the company, right? But how many CEOs are actually able to talk like human beings on LinkedIn? Because that would to me be perhaps one of the major challenges of someone trying to be the lead storyteller of any organization, is, are they actually able to talk like people? And they don't need to be fantastic storytellers, but they just need to sound like a human being talking and not sound like a whole bunch of talking points or, you know, business jargon. And I mean, you've had way more experience with this than I have, but I find that that's a thing that people struggle with.
For sure. We have a lot of people who reach out to us for help with ghostwriting on LinkedIn, for example, because of the reasons you illustrated. They know they should be out there doing something. They're not sure how to do it in a way that isn't abrasive to their constituents, their stakeholders, all of that. I think the answer is that most CEOs that I know aren't terribly active on it. They will kind of post when the marketing team says, "Hey, we need you to post about this." But precious few people do a really good job of being that authentic leader out there on the platform. And I think that's not going to change because they're afraid of making mistakes. There are some companies, though, like Gong is a good example, where the C-suite is out there talking all the time in really interesting, fun, whimsical, provocative ways that has endeared themselves to legions of followers. So I think there's a way of doing it right, as long as you own the voice and you're consistent with that voice. But for me, when I talk to the leadership of companies, I do encourage them to be active on LinkedIn. But rather than doing what I do, which is kind of rattling, you know, the trees and trying to shake things up, I tell them to talk more directionally about the future of their industry. So that's kind of easy to do. They want to be thought leaders. They want to be visionary people. So they can talk directionally about what they see happening in the industry and why what they're presently seeing is about to change. So that's a good way of being provocative without necessarily being abrasive. And I think that's probably appropriate for the role of a CEO. You know, now that can be different. There are some companies that I would encourage to pick a fight with a giant competitor to have that David Goliath type thing. And if that's the case, my counsel would be different. But generally speaking, I tell CEOs or people in the C-suite to be provocative about the direction of your industry. And that is sufficient to be engaging and interesting without pissing off the people who sign your paychecks.
I love the idea of you trying to ghostwrite for a CEO, and all of a sudden, all of his or her posts are a whole bunch of emojis talking to each other. And the post ends with a little hand saying, "This is the way." Terry, I'm not sure that's my voice on LinkedIn.
Yeah, so that's a very unique send-off, I will say. This is the way.
I love it. I think it's such a recognizable thing. You know, I've gotten into the habit of using the sort of rock and roll emoji. And I sometimes, like, I don't do it in every single post, but like, I started a newsletter recently, and then now every single newsletter ends with a little rock and roll emoji. But it's good. I mean, there's this cozy feeling of, okay, this is a Perry post. There will be a little hand at the end of it saying, "This is the way." Sometimes you might have to, it's like, not sure this really works for this post, but screw it, right?
Well, you know, one of the goals, whether you're using those emojis or not, is to have people recognize your post. They can read your post and just know that it's yours. And I think that's the sign that you've got a good cadence and a good rhythm on that platform.
It just made me think of something, because I've mentioned this a couple of times. People who are listening to this who haven't followed your LinkedIn might have no idea what I'm talking about, which is that sometimes when you post and you're having conversations, instead of doing dialogue with words, a lot of the dialogue is done by little emojis, you know, eyebrows raised or looking angry and all of that. And it's a very particular thing. It's kind of funny. And what I was thinking about is that is very unconventional way of, it's a very unconventional way of showing an interaction between people. How unconventional can PR communications get? Now, I'm not saying you're doing emoji conversations for your clients, but I think a lot of people, correctly or not, have this impression of PR in general, at least press releases. Maybe I'm just thinking of press releases, of being a very stodgy, boring thing. I don't think they would ever expect any type of press release to in any way be engaging. They would think it's the type of dross that we now see. A lot of companies love to post on LinkedIn. It's like, nobody cares. Like, why would you even bother putting this on social media? So how unconventional can those communications get?
So it's a good question. I think what seems unconventional to most isn't feeling unconventional to me and us, because we've been doing a little bit differently. So I'll give you an example. So traditional PR, that's things like press releases and speaking opportunities and awards and, you know, all the traditional componentry of PR. Now, I think there's value for all that stuff, and we still do all that. Like, and that's not going to end anytime soon, I'm sure. But I think if you're only doing those things, you're playing half of the modern PR game. What I mean by that is there are things like we're doing right now, this podcast, as a way of telling your story and getting your message out there. There are splinter groups like on Slack and Discord and Substack and all these different places where your audience, little pockets of your audience, lives. And so I think when I think most people think of unconventional PR, it's doing the spade work that I'm doing today, and that we recommend our CEOs and CMOs do, which is appear in those podcasts, join that Slack community, post on LinkedIn, go to Reddit, go here, go there. Like, that's kind of the new game of PR in addition to the old game. And if you combine both of those things in aggregate, this is going to sound familiar, it'll help build that halo effect over your brand. Now, there's a lot of PR agencies that make a lot of money doing press releases and awards and speaking opportunities and media relations, and that's great. I don't begrudge them that at all. The problem with that is that there are far fewer reporters that exist today than did 5 years ago, 10 years ago. There are far fewer publications that exist today. There are newspapers closing every single day. There are fewer reporters covering a great many more companies, services, products. So in order to reach your audience wherever they live, you can't just rely on the traditional stuff anymore. You can't just put out a press release and hope for the best. You can't just pitch one publication and hope for that miracle hit in TechCrunch. You have to be in those places, and you have to be on that whole group of other things I just mentioned. And that's where the magic is lying, and that's where the PR world is moving. So what I'm doing now seems a little old hat to me, because we've been doing this for a while. But I think more and more agencies are realizing, shit, we need to get uncomfortable and start going into these new territories and new directions if we're going to justify the huge monthly spend that our clients are paying us.
And one thing that occurred to me now, as you were speaking about the diminishing number of reporters, is that one of the fairly incredible things about social media that is actually a good thing, I would argue, in a world of social media that perhaps a lot of it is not that good, is how now you don't have the gatekeepers anymore. To a great extent, if you want to create a brand for yourself or get your thoughts out there, you just go and get them out there. Of course, there's a lot of things that still might stop you from doing it, but it's not, you know, the editor of a publication saying this story is not good or that story is good. In your world, what is still the weight of the traditional media, not media as in the newspaper, but, you know, in my world, you being a Forbes contributor means nothing because everybody kind of knows you can hack those things and become a Forbes contributor. So there's no real prestige attached to that. In the world you live in, particularly with tech companies, does that market still care about that type of stuff?
Yeah. So when I think about kind of the universe of opportunity, there's owned channels, and that includes like all of your social. So Twitter or X, whatever you call it, you know, TikTok, LinkedIn, YouTube, like all of those things are owned, but the most power still is earned. So why is that powerful? Earned means that you told your story to a reporter who isn't being paid. I'm not talking about Forbes contributed articles. A regular reporter who is looking at the facts, evaluating the facts, and writing a story based on those facts. That's earned media. And that is the most credible thing that you can possibly have. So if someone's evaluating whether I want to buy this service or that product, an earned media piece by a credible, trusted reporter is still the king, and it's always going to be the king. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't be out there telling your stories in myriad ways on myriad channels that you own. Like, that helps too, and that's valuable as well. But the holy grail is, and I think will forever be, someone else who doesn't owe you a damn thing listening to your story on your own merits and evaluating you fairly and justly. Outcome be damned. And if that's a positive story, then that is a home run. Because now you have something that you're proud of, you can put on your website, you can blog about, you can put on LinkedIn, you can put on Twitter, you can give to your sales team, you can arm your whole universe of folks with that amazing earned piece. And that's far different and far more powerful than any ad will ever be.
And there's one final thing that just came to me, which was, you've talked before about how one of the differences in the way you approach, you know, trying to get a story to a journalist or a reporter, that is very different than the way a lot of people do it, is a lot of people would just kind of do their own PR version of spray and pray without necessarily paying attention to what is the story or the stories that that particular journalist or that particular publication enjoys putting out. Like, what do their audience actually knows them for? And if you're giving them a story that is like that, there's a bigger chance they want to publish it, whereas if you're going against the story. And I think that's a really interesting point, because it applies in slightly tweaked way to a lot of people, which is, if you're going to go against the story that your audience has, you're always going to have an uphill battle. Now, that doesn't mean you cannot be contrarian, but you still have to work on find a common ground before you can go somewhere else. You can't just, well, I know you don't care about this, or you don't ever talk about this, or you're ever interested in this, but here's the story anyway, which I think is good. I don't think that in any context works.
So I think there's a couple things. If I'm talking about pitching a client to a reporter, what I think is the most important thing is to read a bunch of their work to make sure, to your point, that I am not going against the grain and looking for an uphill battle. So that should be table stakes for everyone. It's not. People will do that spray and pray thing, knowing that some percentage of people will cover it no matter what. But I want to point out something that you have done in this interview that is exactly what I talk about all the time. So when you introduced me, you named, you know, a bunch of different things that showed you have read about me, you've read my posts, you've seen some of my podcast performances. Like, you threw a bunch of facts that you couldn't have just gotten in one place because you did the homework. And I'll tell you, that matters. To me, I think to myself, okay, this guy is serious about this and wants to have a real conversation. He put the work in to know who I am, what I've talked about, and ask smart questions based on that. And the same thing applies to reporters. I mean, they're human beings. And if you can appeal to their vanity, like you've done to me by doing that homework up front and showing that you care and that you researched it and that you take it seriously, well, guess what? You're going to have better results. Whereas if you got on and mispronounced my name, you know, didn't say a thing about my history or my past, asked me questions that had nothing really to do with what I'm doing, your results are going to be shitty, like horrible. So this is a great case study of exactly what I preach all the time, which is put in the goddamn work. Know who you're dealing with. I would rather see my team go after 5 people that are exactly the right people that they know cold than 200 people that they've never heard of, or they could care, they could not care. Like, it's a waste of everyone's time. And that's part of what gives PR professionals a bad rap, is they're just like shooting everywhere, hoping for a miracle. Whereas they could instead put their effort to a smaller group of people that they really research and care about and have empathy for as a human being and approach it that way. The results are going to 10x what they would do the other way. So you're a great example of exactly what I preach.
Well, I appreciate that. And also, had I not done the research, I would not have found out that you used to be a Superman underwear child model. I mean, is there any fact about your life that is more interesting than that one?
It's a pretty good one. I got to tell you, I would get teased quite a bit at school for that one, but I think the picture speaks for themselves.
Yes, yes. And I made a point as well of not doing the follow-up to that, which is, and I heard you say this, was something like, you wore a Superman underwear model until you got hit with the ugly stick.
Yes. Well, I'm only 5'8", so Superman's a little taller, a little better looking than that. So, yes.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that if you're modeling underwear, superhero underwear for children, that is a career with a very clear shelf life. I mean, if you remain an underwear model from that age, I mean, I'm not sure that's a life anyone should live.
I think you're right about that.
On that note, the last thing I wanted to run by you is, you were saying earlier that if you're talking to a CEO and you're asking them essentially what are they about and what's their story, and they know it, they could like tell you in one line that that's great and you have a lot less work to do. And I was wondering if the one sort of your story has anything to do with something that I thought about when I was listening to your other podcast, which was that, you know, you are a tech PR agency that is so good, you keep losing clients, but not staff.
Yeah. No good deed goes unpunished, right? So, you know, you do such a great job that your client gets acquired. So, yay, congratulations on your acquisition. I wish you could stick around. But the staff part is really interesting. You know, the average turnover rate in PR is 25% per year, which is a lot. That's 1 in 4 people per year turns over an agency. And think of the disruption if that's your team. You know, I mean, you're going to keep switching team members, having to re-educate them about what your company does. And so that's a real pain in the ass. And part of the reason why I founded the company and we only work with good companies only is so that we could attract people who were good people and only wanted to work on good business. And it's really this virtuous cycle, rather, where if we're not working with any dog companies, any, you know, horrible people, then you tend to have a better experience if you're working on those clients. And also, what company doesn't want to work with an agency known for only working with good companies? I mean, it gives them a little air cover, like, oh, they work with that firm that only works with good companies. We must be good people too. So it's this thing where if it's a stated objective of yours to encircle yourself and build your company around that very simple premise, then good begets good, you know, and it really works. In the 3 years now, we've lost exactly 2 people, which is crazy. It's just absolutely crazy. And one of those people is actively trying to come back still. And we may figure out a way for that to happen. But I can't say enough that of all the things that I have done, I'm most proud of that, of having that good companies only ethos, because I spent 20 years working for other companies, good people and everything. But like, you know, we were chasing every dollar because you want the revenue. And it's just a liberating feeling to say, you know, I'm done with that. We are done with that. We are going to work on the business we want to work on, with good people who don't, you know, berate our team and don't belittle us. And together, we're going to do fantastic work. And it's just been the honor of my lifetime to see this come together. I'm really, really pleased.
Yeah, I think there's something very, very enticing about a no dickheads policy. Although I know a lot of people on LinkedIn who, if they were to apply a no dickheads policy, they might find their business model needs some dramatic overhauling.
I think you're right about that.
Right. On that note, I think we've said a million times that you are on LinkedIn and you're doing your thing on LinkedIn. So I believe that's the best place for people to connect with you if they want more pair in their lives, right?
Well, unfortunately, I can't connect with anybody because LinkedIn has a policy where you can only have 30,000 connections. So I'm maxed out on that. But I encourage everybody to follow me there and engage with me there, and I can communicate with you there. I just can't. I don't know what that rule is, but I can't accept connections anymore. But I would love to see any of your listeners on LinkedIn. Happy to bring more people into the fold, and I'm happy to learn from other smart people. So yeah, I encourage you to come see me there.
Yes, I believe they can follow you and they can join the movement that I'll start, where every single post of yours that comes through my feed will get a comment that says, P.S., where's the Superman picture, Perry? And we'll
well, I will never share it.
See, this is the difference between us. I would 100% share that.
Never.
The post writes itself. This is not good PR.
People don't need to see me in my undies.
I mean, there's a whole series of this is not good PR posts that you can do with just embarrassing stuff. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure, man.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me. It was a great time.
All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Take care of yourselves. And until next time. I hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, I'd love for you to subscribe and leave us a review or a rating on the Apple Podcasts app. It's very easy. You open the app and find this show. Then scroll down a little, and when you see the stars, tap. I'd really appreciate it, and it does help other people find us. And if you'd like to get in touch or find out more about what I do, reach out to me on LinkedIn or visit my website, storypowers.com.